Accession number 9364, Reel 5.
Mr. Bethel, Reel 5. Can you tell me anything about ship traditions on board the Amethyst?
Yes, we had lamp trimmers. That was their job. Marine lamp trimmer, usually, on every ship. Of course, this was prior to the present electricity and that, which wasn't then. And he was quite somebody. As, of course, you had carpenters, you had Putty, as they called him. Putty was the man who painted. He was a painter. It's come quite clever chaps. They were, in many ways, they were tradesmen. And they were able to, of course, latterly you had artificers as the engines became more important and the sails had gone. The captain was the first ship, one of the first ships ever with sails and turrets and that kind of thing. She capsized. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been here if it hadn't been for that. My grandmother married a second time, and as a result, I'm part of the issue. But
did the lamp trimmer do any other duties, or was that his
sole
job?
Oh yes, he had to be a gunner as well. He had to be ran the guns, you know, as well as that. The torpedoman, I remember saying to him as a young lad, you remember, you're half scared and you say, what would you do if we got attacked? And he said, well, I wouldn't fire these torpedo tubes over a distance of 1,000 yards. Well, nowadays they use tracer torpedoes which will follow a ship everywhere it goes. You can imagine that was how he estimated his value as a torpedoman. A nice chap. He lived locally.
Can you tell me any more about onboard activities, what you did when you weren't on watch?
Yes. There was no such thing as bingo. You must realise that although we didn't play it to my memory, the priest of the parish was played all round the fleet. And they used to say the priest of Paris has lost his considering cap. Some say this and some say that. I say so and so. And it was just like a court. And they whack the hell out of you if you were wrong. You had to keep this ritual and bow to the high priest and all this kind of thing. This happened. In this harbour, they used to sing sea shanties just as much as they've got the radio today. And you can hear these sea shanties going all over the harbour. It was beautiful to listen to. Of course, this more in Dad's day than in mine.
But what do you remember of your own off-duty activities?
What did I do? Mainly scrub suits and try and get them clean and dry for the tomorrow, more than anything else. For the first 18 months I was on biscuits. Biscuits and a Tora suet was my main meal. And the cocoa, which was made from a very greasy substance, was issued in basins. You had a basin of cocoa, you know, and the sugar in it was put in the cocoa, and it hardly tasted the sugar at all. You were lucky to get a bit of sugar. We went down to Montevideo, and when we got down there, the cook of those days was responsible for every dish. So if you took up bacon and egg and I took up liver and sausage or something like that, it had to be cooked and put in a plate and given me at lunchtime. And we went down to Montevideo, and from a tin of sloshy bully beef we went to fresh meat, the most gorgeous steak. Every man down there had his own horse, much like the pictures of westerns you see. We went up the River Plate, and it was very much like a cattle station, you know. It was really beautiful to see, really, compared with what we were having on the ship. Anyway, we had all this meat, and it was cooked. The cook was sweating his eyeballs, eh? Tray after tray of meat, and of course, chaps who had not been used to having anything decent to eat. Want me to talk about the...
What was the level of health like, considering the diet?
I would think indifferent. You must realise, I think, that people of previous ages who lived less, were lighter, weren't so good as we are, not so strong. Morally, they may be better. God knows, I don't. But the filth that had been in Rio as a result of prostitutes and all that kind of thing was terrible. I mean, I remember going to the sick berth, seeing a lad there was completely dying of syphilis, more or less, you know, and watching this happen. And although they advised the troops and this kind of thing to keep a man away from what would be normally his wife or his salvation, which was cruel in the extreme, and to see this happen as it must have done in Nelson's day must have been really terrible. They say that every man in the Navy had venereal disease of some kind, and this was sadness.
You were very young when you were on the Amethyst. Were you aware?
14, yes. Generally, if you wanted to corrupt a kid, that was the place to do it. No doubt about it. I ran the football teams, I told you. I loved these children, these boys, and I tried to keep them that they married young girls from socials I ran down there for them, whereby Joan met Peter and that was that, and they married, and this was right in the eyes of God, according to me, as I see it. I mean, I won everything. Well, you had to be successful to make them obey you.
How did the men on board the Amethyst cope with the absence of women?
Well, it was so sad. Everything was sad. When you think that a young chap would scrub somebody else's tunic or his clothes to try and get a couple of bob to send it home to his wife, this was, you know, great sadness. You had men of very high principle who were a great example to the rest. And of course you had the loose ones that came from poor homes where their example had been bad. And consequently, you couldn't build a super race, no question of the Spartans. On the other hand, where did the Spartans get? They murdered all the brains because the brains were the ones that suffered, as I see it.
What was the official attitude to the men going to...
To what, dear?
What was the official attitude to the men going to brothels when they went ashore?
Well, they warned the ship's company, you know, you go ashore at your own peril, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. But, dear, when you get these rapes that are happening in this country today, it's beyond belief. As I see it, these are coming about through idleness, in my opinion, much of it idleness. They should be, you know, more work, more effort.
Did you go ashore?
Well, I used to have £1 a month, and that pound would generally buy me a few licorice all sorts, something like that, and that was nothing else. The guy, the canteen manager, was a Maltese. I think I've already told you this. And he was a great guy. I loved him. Maybe I just got a kindness towards them as a people. But he used to tell me they got stores in, as if it happened to come, which were maybe better armed liner, and we got something from them. But in the dockyard itself, we went in after about 18 months into the... And I've lost the trend of what I was talking about.
I asked what you did when you went ashore from Amethyst.
Well, now, you were issued with two sets of socks, two lots, two socks, imagine, two socks, two pairs. And they were worsted, not the socks you get today, which are fabric, you know, and not liable to shrink. And these things used to shrink right up underneath my heels and my foot, till it was really painful. And I used to go ashore and hobble round. That's all you could do. A cup of coffee would have cost you best part of your pound, so even the mill race, that was the currency in Brazil. I did on one occasion go up the Sugarloaf. Now, the Sugarloaf is a hill which sits right over the mouth of the Great Harbour. It's one of the two greatest harbours in the world. Sydney and Rio are the largest harbours in the world. We did a steam trial in the harbour, you imagine it, 19 knots steaming up down in the harbour, which is rather somewhat something, you know, because the wash of a ship in the harbour generally would be catastrophic if you steamed even at 19 knots. I'm down our harbour, you'd cause damage. We went up to Sugarloaf, went up with a yank. I remember this yank said, "I don't feel any real risk going up here." Well, I'm going up just for the experience. When we got to the top of the Sugarloaf, which we went up by trolley car, you could look down and see the mines, pattern of mines underneath the harbour. And on one occasion, a bloke wanted to know about the particulars of the Amethyst, and of course I told him a lot of tripe, because I realised that, you shouldn't impart information.
How regularly did the ship put into a port?
Oh, we can only... did you find a Brothers Rock? Never. There's a lighthouse there. Six people in a lighthouse. There were, whether it's faded from now, I wouldn't know. We used to put in... Well, for the first 18 months, nowhere. You couldn't put in. Not until Brazil declared war. Then we got two American cruisers, the Maryland and Pittsburgh, and Africa came to... battleship from our Bobby 8 I told you about, and they came to help us. We were allowed in Rio. When in the dockyard, you must realise that the great black country of England was represented. It was so marvellous. You had the feeling you were almost home. The trains, John Bull, and named like that. And you had that feeling that you could feel the industrialists of the black country who had made his mark on South America beside the Spaniard and the Portuguese. And the Maryland, not the Maryland, the Fatherland laid there, the big German liner laid alongside, rusting, unable to move because we had our corner there. This kind of thing, and you had this terrific impressiveness of Britain as it was, and oh God, it was, compared with today, the great influence we had.
How did the local people treat you when you went ashore?
Well, I'll tell you about we played them football, which was, the Latin is by nature passionate. And oh God, we played in football and we won, and our team all went to hospital by one big Marine who came off the ship, and he'd had a dagger up his backside. A chap named Southern. Forget it, I'll put his hammock up for him.
It got into a fight?
Well, they fought us, because if we won, they were going to give us a lot of beer. If we lost, we'd get a lot of beer. If we won, we weren't going to get any beer. They went to hospital instead.
Were you involved in this?
Oh, no. Me, I was the littlest, the tiniest, the silliest mug there. I wouldn't have got stuck into any of these people. They were all big chaps compared with me. And I might like to have gone and seen the match, but Southern was a fair athlete, you know, a Marine. He was big by those standards, which, of course, him and Jackie Hewitt were the great apes. Jackie Hewitt, I doubt whether he could spell his own name. A great big chap. Well, big, as I say, big by their standards.
Were you allowed off the ship at the same time as the other Marines?
Oh, yes. But I was led, I was forced to go ashore. And no money, just walk around the streets. And I remember Mary Pickford was the great star of those days. And you could see her on the picture where Mary Pickford was going to, of course, in Brazilian. And the great hills around Rio are impressive. And when you go up, and we used to march up there with the captain. I used to have to take this drum which hung around my neck like a millstone, climbing these mountains, which were fairly severe, and trying to tap out a rhythm or something as you climbed up. I wasn't very popular.
This was so the Marines could march?
Not marching, climbing, dear. Exercise to get you off the ship. We went into one great mountain top that was hollowed out for slaves, and as you look round this cavern, this great whole hollowed cave at the top of this mountain, you could see where they'd carved their names and that on the wall, slaves. I don't know if you saw that film recently.
What did the local people think when you came ashore?
Well, as I say, originally, apparently, when war was declared, they were fighting in the streets of different people, like people who wanted Germany to win and people who wanted us to win. And it was a case of trying to get the whole savour of feeling on our side. You try to be pretty noble, you try and be, but I'll say the rows of prostitutes and that didn't lend to anything particular. They were only interested in money, you know.
What was your system for getting money for shore leave? You say you had £1 a month. Was
this,
what currency was this in?
Mill rays. I had a 10 mill ray note, which was a fortune to me, but I had it stolen, and that was that. We were ashore for this small period while we were in, having the ship refitted, and
where was this?
In Rio, as I told you about the John Bull, the train, that kind of thing.
Where did you stay while the ship was being refitted?
In this great shed. In a shed. As I told you, the ship had no nothing, no water, no fridge. You're going back to the Nelson's Dome down there, when you think about it, with conditions as they were then. I mean, Nelson must have had a lot of job with water and that kind of thing.
Whilst you were living in this shed, what was your routine? What did you do?
Well, stepped on the floor, and we kept it swept out, that kind of thing. Went ashore if you could, generally, to get out of it.
Did you have any official duties?
Only to sound off any calls they wanted me to make, you know, because you were Jack, nobody's particular body, you just had a routine which was daily, which simply went on and on. You knew you had to sound off evening quarters or whatever it was, and you sounded that, and that was it. And then lights out and that kind of thing.
So your duties didn't vary whether you were ashore or at sea?
No, not really, no. I remember going ashore once, meeting an American. He was sitting on the beach, and I realised that he wasn't. I said, "What are you? You speak English?" "Yes," he said, "I'm an American." And we just parleyed for a while, you know, and I tried to sum him up. He probably tried to sum me up, but there is this about the American, there is no doubt about it. They are a great race of people, irrespective of the fact that they're not as we are.
What news did you hear of the war, the progress of the war?
Oh, we used to get what they called the Pendu. And this Pendu which came through in typewritten sheets. We had these great tall masts which helped us to get Horsey Island there in Portsmouth. And they were very, very high. No doubt they helped the ship to roll because, you know, they were so high for such a tiny ship. We used to get news of France, you know, and we've taken the L-60 and this kind of thing, and we haven't taken it, we've lost it, and conditions as they were, which were all frightening to me. I used to write home about once, whenever there were ships, whenever the mail went, which was not dependable. It might go and it might be torpedoed, you wouldn't know. And of course you got a letter from home. It brought us wrong. You never found it. We went up to Bayeux, when we were coming home. They told us we could have 40 pounds of sugar each. And we went to Bayeux, which is above Rio, Brazilian. Brazil's quite big, isn't it? And we got this 40 pound of sugar, and we had nowhere to put it. And it was hot. And it just melted in a great big football. Demerara sugar, imagine. And it just got into a ball and dripped. And the chap going past and put a drip down his neck. Your bloody sugar again. And so on. And of course, some of the chaps who had a little bit more know-how than I did, possibly have somewhere cooler to put it. God knows where you could have put it to keep it cool, only in water. There was no other way of keeping it cool. And I brought a pound of butter. And I bought a pound of butter ashore because I thought my mum was starving. And we eventually, having left Brazil, or coming up for the way home, we took a lot of bullion on to bring back and come across to Sierra Leone. When we got to Sierra Leone, we found that the Africa and Britannica, the Britannia, two of the Wobbly Eight, were burying people daily with flu. Lots of people were dying. They couldn't make the coffins quick enough. We were glad to push off. Eventually we went on the way to Gibraltar.
Did Did you have any losses on board the Amethyst?
Not with flu, no. Strange enough, I don't think we stayed long enough to catch it. We stayed about 2 days, that's all. And it was very... Of course, flu was home in England as well at that period. It was possibly due to the lack of sanitation, the bodies dying in France. I don't know, I imagine so. It could have been caused the epidemic. And we made our way to Gibraltar and then finally home.
How did you hear that you were going home?
Well, it was generally known, you know, they said we were going home. Actually, we knew that we were less important when America came in the war because of Britannia and Africa and the Maryland and Pittsburgh were bigger than us. They could handle anything within reason. And I got to Barrow-in-Furness. I decided I'd go ashore with the few pennies I had. When I got ashore, I said, what can I have to eat? Can I have anything? Yes, they said, you can have what you want, what do you want? I said, can I have bacon and eggs? And they said, yeah.
How did you feel about going home?
And I ate this bacon and eggs and went back to the ship. I bought myself a pair of kippers and opened the tin of butter and ate it. In sheer disgust. And I came home trundling home with my ball of sugar. And next door were my two sisters, both accomplished, playing Roses of Picardy, and oh God, I knew a different world. I knew a stinking world, a different world than they knew. Roses of Picardy might have been all right to them, but it wasn't to me. It was great sadness. And of course, Doris and Stella, they played piano, violin. Doris was she was brilliant and musically, and so was Stella.
This was a special homecoming for you, was it?
Well, just no. It was kind of special to me, wasn't too special for them.